candy shop. We speaking on things you not. Just press play and let it rock. Welcome to the candy shop. Whoa. Welcome to the candy shop. We speaking on things you not. Just press play and let it rock. Welcome to the candy shop. Whoa. Feel like we going through mad things. Gotta keep it real when they choose not. We gon' talk about it when the news drop. Welcome to the show where you know we don't fake this. Keep your opinion to yourself if it don't make sense.
Hey, 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 podcast family. It is your girl, Candidly Kristen, and this is The Candid Shop, your number one destination for candid conversations. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're a returning listener, welcome back and thank you for your support. So I am really excited to have with me today, filmmaker, writer, professor, director of the Digital Race Lab, and author of the critically acclaimed book, When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age, Dr. Robert Eshman. Welcome, 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 Dr. Robert, to The Candid Shop.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to talking with you.
As am I. So racism and resistance are timeless and important topics. Mm. And your book and your work, you know, your broader work kind of dives deep into the ways that technology and online communications are changing how we experience, understand, and respond to racism on and offline. So I want to get right into it.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
All right. So first I got to ask you, who is Rob Eshman? Just tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Chicago, from the north side, a neighborhood called East Rogers Park. We used to call it the North Pole. You know, I graduated from Chicago Public Schools. I'm someone who, what drove me to academia and to being a researcher is seeing and reading about or seeing disparities in public school funding, just my own experiences as a kid, mm-hmm. and then reading about the connections between inequality in education and, you know, later economic inequality or, and it just made me think about education as a education reform, as a tool for organizing in a Black community and one of the many ways that we can engage in fighting racism, right, at a structural level. Okay. And so that you know, that's who I am, is that the work that I do for me is very tied to, a mission of wanting Black folks to be free and being tired of, you know, the ways that we've been beaten down over the years and really being inspired by the ways that our communities have come together to do the work, and that I'm always proud and inspired by folks who are on the ground and working and fighting to make change.
Yes, same here. So your book, I have a copy. I haven't gotten through all of it. But tell me what inspired you to write it? Like, was there a precipitating event or moment where you said, I need to kind of explore this this digital age as it impacts racism and resistance?
That's a great question. I think it was not one event. It was more so a string of events throughout my life that kind of led to me realizing that this is a story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. I opened the book talking about the first time that I was called the N-word and how that was just online playing video games.
Right.
This is experience I had when I was younger. It just left me with the question of, right, what does racism online tell us about racism in the real world? Should I be looking at people sideways who play this game where online the norm is to use the N-word like that, right?
Right.
And so this is it, right? This is something that's personal and not a research experience. And okay. Then when I first got to grad school, right, one of the first PhD classes I took was The Social Meaning of Race. Huh. And in that class, we read a book called Racism Without Racism by Eduardo Bonilla Silva, where it talked about subtle racism or colorblind racism as being the dominant form of racism. And you know, really a powerful analysis of the ways that racism, it can, when it's structural, it does not require people to have hate in their hearts,
right,
to yell out the N-word in order to maintain racial boundaries, right? And right. So really, it's a powerful analysis, but it also made me think, you know, this doesn't quite fit with my experiences on the internet, where people are much more likely to pop off with some explicit racism than in my personal experiences in face-to-face settings. And so that really led me down a path and the beginnings of an investigation into what is distinct about communication online. What is different about the ways that we talk about race online? What makes those conversations different? And then what are the effects that it has on folks of color, on society, that you have this ugliness that's taking place online? And so really that is, I said that, you know, those two things marked the beginning of my thinking. But then really the study began when I heard about a college campus, where a campus-based website had popped up.
Okay.
That it anonymized student comments so that they could have discussions without their names being attached, but you had to be a student to post to it. And okay. This website just turned into a horribly racist website that, you know, students could not believe that, you know, that this was going on campus, that people who were on their campus felt, you know, these ways about students on campus. So, for example, one post talked about, why are there so many Black people in the library? If I want to hear, right, if I want to hear, you know, kind of, Black people talk, I'll go to the ghetto.
Wow.
And right, like what message does that send to Black students on campus to know that when they're in the library, people are listening to them and thinking, oh, you don't belong here. And right. So that is really where I started the study, is I talked to students of color on this campus about their experiences with race, both in person and online, to really try and make some sense of, you know, what seemed to be a contradiction.
Gotcha. And in those questions to these students, was there something that jumped out at you in terms of the way they experience racism in a digital space versus in the real world?
Yeah, I think that not everyone was aware of how race was impacting their lives in the real world. But yet some folks who are students of color who were just, they were happy. They did not feel like they're experiencing racism. When they did see racism, they minimized it and saw it as being, oh, this is, you know, a kind of an outlier. This is not characterize our campus, our university. And it wasn't until the website that they began to realize, like, wow, racism is still here. I thought this was
right. Right.
And so I think for some people, it was a wake up call to realize that the world is not as friendly as we thought it was. For other people who, you know, had the understood, right, who were able to see and interpret and understand subtle forms of racism like microaggressions, they weren't surprised, and they use it as evidence. Like, look, I told y'all people are so racist. You weren't listening to me. Now you see it and stop, right? Stop telling me that I'm crazy.
Right.
For complaining about racism on this campus. And so, right, so I think that you know, like to see that distinction that you know, it's alarming for all of us, but it has a different impact on us, right? Like if I see a video of police violence, it is horrifying to me, but it is also not surprising to me because I've been, you know, seeing and hearing about police violence my whole life. But then for folks who did not know that police acted that way, for folks who really believe the myth that they're here to serve and protect, those videos can be, you know, can really, you know, change their worldview.
Right. So, Dr. Rob, I'm gonna call you Dr. Rob. How do you feel that technology, social media, the media, has had and will shape the dynamics and discussions about race and resistance?
You know, I think that for a long time, conversations about race have been taboo. I think that the literature, right? I think that Black folks of color are often wary of talking about race in, you know, certain mainstream contexts because it can get them in trouble. Right. That when you start challenging power, that there can be consequences and repercussions for doing that. that would you that you don't want to offend the white folks who are around you, right. when that can impact your check or your friendships, your relationships. And so I think that these are things that typically we don't speak about or we have not spoken about. And I think one of the big things that's happening is that, activists and folks of color on social media have been pushing the issue and forcing it into national attention. They are not allowing, you know, the norms of silence that, you know, that characterize so many spaces in you know, mainstream spaces and face-to-face settings. They reject those norms online and say, no, we're going to talk about this. I'm going to call you out. I'm going to tell you the story of what happened to me. And here I'm not as, you know, worried about the consequences of telling you the story as I might be if I was in the break room at the office. Right. And so I think that it really is pushing us to have the hard conversations that we've needed to have for a very long time. And I think that that is hugely important, is to be able to engage in those discussions. And then beyond that, I think that what we're seeing in terms of, so I guess, that's talking about race, but that's also part of resistance, is that racism reproduces in silence, that when we don't challenge racism, it is allowed to stay. Right. Yeah. The racist systems, if left unchecked, can grow. And so us talking about them is the first step of resistance, that we have to identify the problem and point it out to people. And I think that that is what we're seeing with social media resistance, is that people are being woken up, that the powers are being challenged, and we're able to have a more intelligent conversation about race when people have the vocabulary and the language to understand that racism is more than just individual level attacks or individual prejudice, but it's also the you know, the ways that society and different institutions are set up to privilege some people over others. And so that is what, you know, that's what we're seeing happening. And I think it's been very exciting. It is unfortunate that now we seem to be in a moment of the pendulum swinging back where, you know, the races are saying, hey, we're tired of y'all making these terms trend on Twitter, so we're going to start banning critical race theory, we're going to start banning diversity in schools, so because we want less people to know about the things that you're talking about. And so I think that that is a that, you know, it is unfortunate, and it means that we still have to fight, but it also shows that the work has been you know, effective to some degree, that people are scared and they want to stop the conversations that have been happening.
And I think, to me, what I see, in addition to those things, what social media in particular has done is kind of empower racists, because it's anonymous. They don't have to worry about being seen, or, you know, they can say what they say and it's just out there.
That's real. That's real. I think that, that there's a long history of white supremacists using technology intentionally. And so, right, so there's a mix of these things. That one, you have white supremacist groups who use tech and social media to recruit people and to share their ideas. The other is that you may have regular, ordinary white folks who are not connected to any white supremacist groups, but who pop off at the mouth when they're on social media, and you get a taste of what they really think, or the things that they would usually say in private, but not in public. And so absolutely, I think that social media can amplify marginalized voices. And that, right, so when people feel like their point of view can't be shared in person, online, they may feel a little bit more comfortable. And that includes, you know, giving racist space. And so, I think that that's problematic. I think that it can create harm. I think that the data shows that that when people are exposed to racism, Black folks and folks of color, it hurts our mental health. It makes you it has a negative impact on our well-being and makes us more stressed. And you know, I think that those are things that we need to figure out how to combat. But at the same time, I think that when they show themselves, it is waking us up collectively to understand where racism lives and how prevalent it is, and how, you know, how we still need to be organized to fight for change, despite, you know, so many, you know, like there are lots of people who have comfortable lives and don't feel like there's something to fight for until, you know, there's a new hashtag and say, no, this is an ongoing battle. And for me, when I see those, you know, that racism online, it is a constant reminder that we are still in the midst of a freedom struggle.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. Did you encounter any pushback or challenges while both researching and writing this book?
Hmm. I did.
And I guess specifically from non-BIPOC people, like from white people or.
Well, you know, so I don't have the burden of being famous, right? I don't have all the crazy. there are less crazies in my inbox, right, than the people who have, you know, a couple million followers on Twitter.
Right.
And so not that type of pushback where people are trying to shut me down. I would say there, I have gotten some of those crazy emails after something is published and someone will say, you know, send me a million links and you know, but nothing that has been too disruptive to my life.
Okay.
I would say that, you know, I did get some feedback from folks who are, you know, invested in seeing me have a successful career as an academic. And that sometimes, right, in the field that I'm in, writing a book before tenure may not be the wisest thing because it takes you your time away from doing the things that are, you know, more likely to get you tenure. So like having more articles or getting more grant funding, et cetera. Right? But for me, this is something I was passionate about and I wasn't willing to put on hold until post tenure. Right. And then, you know, and I guess challenges, I think I encountered a lot of challenges just in the process of doing the research and writing that one of the things, right, when I started the project, I was talking to students at one school and then I expanded it to talking with folks at five different schools.
Okay.
And then, you know, I had all this data, but I thought, oh, you know, I don't know if this is enough because this tells me now I'm just right. If it writes to the data, I have 86 interviews with students around the country. But I didn't just want to write a book about how, you know, technology is changing the way we talk about and experience race and racism on college campuses. I wanted to speak more generally. And so then I had the challenge of developing, you know, new skills and doing social media data analytics so that I could bring that into the book. Right. In addition to the interviews, I've got, you know, data on millions and millions of tweets over a period of a decade to look at different trends. And so, right, that was a challenge that I had to overcome. It was a fun chat. It was fun to overcome. And I also am very fortunate to have friends and collaborators and resources that allow me to do those things. So definitely there are challenges along the way, but then the type of challenges that, you know, as a critical thinker and as a problem solver, were things that are to be expected.
Right.
And things that I think really kind of increased my motivation to figure out how to, you know, say everything that I wanted to say in the book, despite the difficulties, you know, methodologically.
Got it. So were there any surprises, surprising discoveries or insights that kind of showed up during your research and writing process? Anything that made you go, huh?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So one I'll say, and I, you know, I touched on this a little bit, is I started the study, remember, is that case study of the racist website.
Yeah.
I thought I was just going to write something about how, you know, kind of connecting sociological theory to racism online. And that this is going to be a story about how students of color are being victimized by online racism. And I was surprised to hear that you know, what was happening was not just students of color feeling victimized, but that really the most exciting part about the story is how students of color resist racism online. Mm-hmm. And they began telling me stories about how they feel more comfortable challenging racism online than they do in person, giving me all these examples. And I think that was a more exciting and unanticipated part of the study for me. And took it in a whole new direction where, you know, I think that the part of the book talks about how online communication changes, you know, the ways we talk about race. But another part talks about how it changes the way that we resist racism. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was an unexpected direction that I really think defines the book now. I will also say, I think it was unexpected for me to really struggle with my writing style, right? That I am someone who is an academic. Mm-hmm. I write peer-reviewed articles. I'm doing science, right? With this book, I was very intentional about writing it for a non-science audience. I didn't want to write this book just for the folks who are in academia. I want to write this folks for people who are interested in thinking about and learning about race without having to, you know the academic jargon. And so I think that for me, I really completely changed the way that I wrote in order to make sure that this is accessible for a broad audience. And that was harder than I thought it would be. And I guess, you know, I shouldn't be surprised that after, you know, over a decade of being in academia and writing in a certain way, that to find a new style and to really find my voice was a difficulty. But it was something that I was pleasantly surprised to find that I could change that, because that is, I don't want to be stuck in the ivory tower, that I want right. this work to be meaningful for people who are, you know, living in the world.
Yeah. And it is accessible. It's not a hard read at all. So
thank you.
You kind of answered this next question, but what was your hope like that readers took away from the book, and secondarily, what impact do you want that particular body of work to have on the broader discussion about racism and resistance?
Yeah. So I think that is a great question. My hope, let me say one of my hopes, right? So, and I think I have many hopes at different moments that some are closer to the surface for me. But one of my hopes is that, right, because the reality is I don't think the people who are trying to ban conversations about race are not mm-hmm. the ones who are going to pick up the book. It's the people right. who already have some interest in thinking about racism.
Right.
And my hope is that this book not only right, like, will not only help them understand how race and racism is changing in the digital age, mm-hmm. but then also give them the tools that they need to engage in conversations and engage in, you know, thinking about interventions or thinking about how to pursue change that mm-hmm. is informed by, what's going on, and the data. Right. So I think that is what I would hope, is that you read this book and now when you have that hard conversation with the uncle who was a Trump supporter over Thanksgiving, yes. you feel a little bit more equipped, right? That you got some ammo that this book is giving you. That is one of the hopes that I have, is that it helps people understand what's happening, but then also helps them be able to explain what's happening to other people. And then remind me, what was part two of that question?
Part two is, what impact do you want your work to have on the broader discussion about racism and resistance?
Yeah. I think that the some of the important work that we can do now is about being able to name and highlight where racism lives. And I think that is part of the work that I'm doing in this book, is really unmasking racism online and showing us how it continues to be something that is, you know, dictating the opportunities and limitations that we have in our lives.
Yeah.
And I think that what I want the book to do is to unmask those things in a way that empowers people who are fighting against racism, so that mm-hmm. we can, so that we know exactly who it is that we're up against and what it is that we're up against, so we can come together. And part of what I try to do, too, is to point out the importance of online racism, but also to make sure that we know that we cannot limit ourselves to just organizing online.
Right.
That we need to match this online organizing with, you know, traditional methods of organizing. And that's something that I do in the book, is I have a couple moments where I step back and talk about strategies and philosophies of the classic, you know, or the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
And really trying to make the connection between what activists were doing then, what we're doing now, and what the differences are, and what, you know, the new things we can do because of technology, but also the old things that we can't forget about because technology right. may be a little bit easier in some moment.
Right. Yes, I like that. You, sir, are not only a writer and an academic, you're also a filmmaker. So talk to me about how those diverse parts of who you are intersect or informed how you address, like, racism and resistance, and then we're going to talk about film.
yeah, we could do that. So I have been an amateur filmmaker for a long time. That every mm-hmm. year I make a short film. We submit it to this festival with my family. It's funny. I have like 13 years of films with my kids, And so I can watch my kids grow up through these films that we've been making every year. We're right. Like you got, I got a film with my daughter at a year, right, you know, tossing an iPad around. And then now my daughter's 14. Right. And so it's like,
wow,
this is, we've been doing this for fun for a long time, but then never was it professional. It was just kind of, you know, I'm someone who loves fiction. Mm-hmm. I've always written fiction in my own free time. I have a creative family. My little sister, Reese Eshman, is an author who's written 5 kids' books. Mm-hmm. And so like we get together and we make these movies. The first time that I went after or started to pursue filmmaking professionally was really after the findings of this book. One of the things that came out is that, right, so the research says that the most common way to respond to racial microaggression, kind of a subtle racial slight, is to not respond. But then online, you know, it's a different story. The students talk to me online about how, hey, you know, like in person, people don't respond to things like this, but online, I've never seen a situation where someone doesn't comment on a racial joke. It always gets called out. It's a different dynamic. And so what I wanted to do is explore what the barriers are to responding to racial microaggressions in person, and to really use technology or use film to model different forms of responding to racism and microaggressions that hopefully can impact, the people's comfort level with doing that in real time. So really I'm trying to take what I've learned can be empowering to students in an online setting and figure out how can we then now use film to kind of develop a training tool or using stories to help people think about those processes in their lives. And so what we did is the film is called Choose Your Own Resistance.
Yes.
It's a short film in virtual reality. And I'm sorry, am I getting ahead of myself? Is this
no, that was literally the next.
Okay. And so the film is about so when we think about virtual reality films, it's like you embody a different character. Mm-hmm. So the film is multi-perspective. You embody the characters of a young Black man who's getting microaggressed, a bystander who witnesses the event, and then the microaggressor. And you see the world from all 3 of their perspectives. And then you see alternate endings, right? So you see the situation where there is no response to the microaggression. Then you see the situation where there is a response to the microaggression. And just we're looking at the different causes and consequences around the choice of, do I challenge racism in this moment? And so this is this is something that was a joy to me to be able to collaborate with experienced filmmakers and actors, and really have a story that was developed out of interviews with with students about their real world experiences. Right, we call that participatory design. That the research participants played a hand in developing this film, and I'm really excited. It's almost done. I just opened an email from some folks who are doing the final sound mixing on the music. And so it's like, it's almost ready for the world, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, you got to make sure I get a link so I can put it in the show notes with the link to your book. I didn't realize when I was kind of, putting together the outline for this chat that Choose Your Own Resistance came after When the Hood Comes Off.
Yeah, it did.
A product of. Nice. I love it.
Yeah, it is kind of my post-book project that I turned the book in, and then this is what I got to working on, is working on the film. And so it's something that I, has been a journey for me, learning a new craft. And I'm really, really enjoying it and very happy to be exploring how storytelling can empower folks who are trying to do anti-racist work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And visual media is important. I'm a reader, but I also am visual. And some people are both and some people are either or. So sometimes seeing things visually helps. And I love the multi-perspective, because often we're only reacting, responding out of our own lived experiences. And it helps to see somebody else's vantage point, to be in their shoes looking at the situation. You know, I wear locks.
Okay.
So the microaggression with locks is just ridiculous. I mean, hair in general, folk wanting to touch your hair, like, really? I think it's very important to have, to leverage the power of literature and visual media to do this work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So listen, how does Dr. Rob balance the work of addressing racism while maintaining hope, resilience, and self-care in doing the work?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, I think, let me start with the last one first. Self-care. I have never struggled with self-care.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah. And, you know, before self-care was like this trending thing.
Right.
That's just how I've always lived my life. And I think that's how I was raised too. My mom used to give us mental health days, right? There was no being stressed in the house. Like, I mean, stay home, man. Go get you some tea and relax.
Right.
And you know, I think that's just how I've always operated, where it's like a, and it's not even that I'm thinking about mental health in those moments, but I can tell when my body or my mind needs a break. Mm-hmm. I take a break, and that can be, you know, I love sports. I love playing basketball.
Okay.
And so for me, right, maybe hitting the gym. I tore my Achilles playing basketball, so I went through a rehab process. So that was a little bit of a struggle for me to find ways to, you know, stay active despite, to stay sane despite having my, you know, my foot be in a boot where I can't really walk. But that's something that I love, going to the gym. I love playing ball. I love hitting the weights. I love going to the movies, right? I watch a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. I just love spending time with my kids. We hang out, and the older that they get, the more fun it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's just a lot of my life that is not, you know, this academic work. And I think that, it's easy for me to maintain that balance, because it comes naturally. Right. And so, a lot of those things I don't always think about as being self-care, but when I examine my life, it is full of self-care.
Absolutely.
And so it's something that I take, you know, that is important to me, having balance. Right.
Yeah.
And I think the kids force me to do it too, is that I can't, they know to them, I can't not be there for them. And that means that I have to be done working at a certain
time. Right.
And then, in terms of just, you know, maintaining hope, now that can be tough, because it's almost like the more you learn about racism, the bigger the problem seems, right?
Right, right.
So that is a struggle. But then I think that my philosophy really is, if you look historically at the things that we've overcome, I really do have faith that things can get better.
Yeah.
And I think, right, I think but I also don't think that it will happen automatically.
Right.
Or right, kind of incrementally, that we really do have to be fighting for radical change if we want to see any change. Yeah, I think my hope comes from the past and seeing all that we've done, and that makes me hopeful for the future. And knowing that our people, that we are resilient, and I believe that the more we expose racism, the more we show people what it looks like and its effects, the more people are going to be on the side of, hey, we need to end this thing. That's where my hope comes from.
Okay. All right. So forward looking, how do you see the entire landscape of activism, resistance evolving in response to our digital age and challenges from that digital age?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that during the civil rights movement, activists had to strategize around having to get the attention of the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And, the journalists didn't always want to cover what was going on with the civil rights movement. So we had to be intentional about how do we make sure the cameras are on when these dogs are attacking, so the world can see what the ugliness of racism here.
Right.
And I think that now with social media, one of the most exciting things that online activism can do is bypass those media gatekeepers and force the issue. We can make something go viral without the journalist saying, yeah, look, we'll cover this. And now the journalists have to cover it because we made it go viral.
Right.
So I think that is something that is exciting about the future of activism. But I think that we're also seeing the powers that be recognize this and begin to make changes.
Yeah.
From Elon Musk taking over Twitter to, you know, Facebook, Instagram limiting activists posting on certain social issues, that we are seeing the social media giants can become the new gatekeepers of information, that really, you know, can keep us from sharing, messages about justice. And so I think that that is something that is scary, and it's something that we have to, continue to think about and really come up with a way that we want to attack that issue, or ways that we want to keep our movement alive despite
the obstacles,
them trying to stop it. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that those are some things that I think are on the horizon, is how do we, right, how are we going to maintain this momentum that we have when social media becomes an environment that is hostile to activism?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great segue. So how can we, what are, in your opinion, some ways that individuals, communities can combat racism online and off?
Well, I think that combating racism online, it may be as simple as leaving a comment, sending a message, and letting people know that, hey, this is problematic. And you may not always get a good response, but I think and it's something that can be tiring for people. So if you don't have the energy, I'm not telling you what to do.
Right.
But I think that can be an important action. Right. And so I have a study where we looked at people who tweeted Colin Kaepernick hate when he took a knee. Yeah. Protests anti-Black police violence.
Yeah.
People were burning his jersey and, they saying, calling him un-American. And we did a study to look at people who are anti-Kaepernick, and we followed them for a week, and we looked for people who made concession.
Right.
So people who said, you know what, you're right, I can see a different point of view. Maybe he's not anti-American. Okay, he has the right to protest. And we wanted to understand what happened to make those people change their minds or make a concession in such a short amount of time. And one of the things we found is that people who receive more messages are more likely to change their mind. Just engaging people in conversation helped them to see a different point of view. And we think about all these online discussions or arguments as being, oh, there's no point in arguing, like no one's ever going to change their mind. And, and sometimes that's true. Sometimes you have people who, they're so set in their ways that they're not going to hear you when you're talking. But the evidence also shows this can, you can really cause someone to rethink their point of view. Why, right? If you send them a link like, hey, I see you're talking about this, check out this information on what's really happening in prison. And the right, like you may be able to change in people's minds. And I think that's what we're seeing with trends in social media discourse, is that activists on social media have really been pushing folks to be able to think more critically about justice issues in a way that I think is powerful. So I think, just talking about it, educating yourself, and finding ways to really get engaged and face-to-face work too, and not being satisfied just with social media activism.
Yeah. And I think misinformation is problematic when you talk about the digital landscape. Like, there's so much misinformation. So it's really important when you're engaging online or off that you have accurate information, so you're not just fighting misinformation with more misinformation.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And misinformation is scary. And I think that's one of the scary things about AI is the ways that misinformation can be developed so much faster and spread more widely. And so that's definitely something that we have to figure out. How do we combat misinformation? We don't know sometimes when things are trending, whether they came from bots or came from Russia, we don't know where this came from.
Yeah.
And we have to be careful before we retweet something as fact, right? Like you can see a picture and someone says, oh, this is from Israel, Palestine. And really we don't, right? That maybe that was something that was taken in 2015 in Yugoslavia, right? Like, we don't know, right? We need to double check. We need to fact check when we see things. And I think that there are people in places that are doing that work, but then we have to be able to identify and challenge the myths and the misinformation that can go viral and really have a negative impact on the media landscape in terms of folks being tricked into thinking something is real that's not.
That's not. Yeah, absolutely. So, Dr. Rob, what is your best piece of advice for writers, educators, filmmakers, activists who are passionately trying to address racism?
Ooh, this is interesting. You know, I think that for me, a big part of being a producer, of whether it's of knowledge or of art, is being a consumer. And I think that I'm someone who I have a voracious appetite for reading, for, you know, watching films. You know, I am constantly, I have lots of inputs, right? Like I'm, you know, going to museums, that I am always around creative things, and that allows me, that kind of feeds me, so that I'm full and I have things to give, right? And so I think that I would encourage folks to keep learning and to keep seeking growth, right? Whether you're a filmmaker, whether you're an academic, the more you know about what other people have done, the easier it will be for you to figure out where it is you want to do your work, what needs to be done based on what you've learned, right? Where are the holes that you can have an impact, and you could contribute to the conversation or help the issue. What has been done that you love that you want to build on? Right. It's not stealing, right? When you admit that stuff, right? Like, man, I love that you did this, and based on that, I want to do this. That is a beautiful way that art is done and that research is done. And so really, it's, you know, I'd say it's staying full and making sure that you have the right inputs the right kind of media and knowledge diet to make sure you're consuming the right thing.
Yeah. Awesome. 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 Gosh, this is an amazing chat. Like, seriously, it's as a member of the African American community, it's an important one for me personally, but I think it's bigger than that. I mean, we all have to live on this planet together. So,
yeah.
You know,
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. This was you're asking a hard question too. It's a good question.
good. Thank you so much for that. But we're not done. That was the serious part. Now we get to the fun stuff, and we get to play 10 Candid Questions.
All right.
All right. So just 10 random questions that I found online. Only rule is that you have to answer them candidly. Okay. You ready?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Number one, what is your favorite curse word?
Oh man. I'm going to go with damn, because there are so many different ways you could say it. Mm-hmm. So many different inflections and meanings. Yes. And it's probably the most appropriate one in many settings too.
Yes. Yes.
Right. They say damn in kids books.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's one of my favorites. Second to the F-bomb. That's my favorite. So, question number two, handshakes or hugs?
I'm going to go hugs.
Okay. Question number three, what is the most valuable lesson you've learned from a mistake or failure in your life?
Ooh. You know, I think, I had hoop dreams as a kid, and I was really good at basketball in high school. I was recruited to play at a lot of colleges. Okay. I was a D1 recruit, and basketball did not work out for me.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, some of my peers back then never gave up the hoop dream, and I gave it up real quick. And I went, and I went to college, and it was the first time I was trying in academia or trying in school. In high school, I didn't try, right? Things just kind of came easy to me. And I think once I realized that basketball was not my future, I was not going to be the next Allen Iverson in the NBA. Right. I applied myself to different things. And I think that was really right. I do see that as being a failure, that I worked my whole life to try and be a basketball player, that didn't work out. But then I took that work ethic and applied it in other places. And I think that that is a lesson for me, that failure in one thing doesn't mean that your life is over. And that, it's completely possible that that thing is not for you, but there is something else that's for you. And absolutely, I think that is something that I apply consistently in my life, that I may have a passion, something that I'm go for. And it also may not be for me, or it may just be for fun and never something I share with the public. And I think that's okay.
Okay. Question number four, early bird or night owl?
Depends on the day. I could be both.
Same.
Coffee allows me to be both.
Okay. Question five. What motivates you to get up in the morning?
Ooh. That's a tough one. You know, there's some mornings I'm not motivated to get up, and the other morning there's a deadline that motivates me. You know, in general, I'd say I think life is a beautiful thing. I'm grateful to be living, and I feel like I have a lot of joy in my life, and so I think that just gratitude for this experience.
Nice. Okay, that's a good answer. Question six: sunrise or sunset?
Oh, I'm gonna go sunset.
Okay, all right. Question seven: if you were stranded on a deserted island and could only bring three things, what would they be?
I'm gonna say a laptop that is a special laptop that is equipped with Wi-Fi connection.
And solar power, because you won't have any electricity.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, let me get a wind turbine too.
Right.
that way I have access to unlimited books and movies. And then I'm gonna also give me a basketball, and so okay. I can have something to do with my hands too.
Okay.
Oh man, there's no survival tools in there though.
Well, it may not be anything you need to use that for, but you might need it for, you know, a fishing pole or something just so you can eat. I don't know.
right.
Okay. Question eight: texts or phone calls?
I'm gonna say phone calls. I'm old school. I still call people out the blue, and I don't mind getting calls either. So.
Okay. All right. Question number nine: what are you not very good at?
Holding my tongue.
That's not a bad thing at all.
It can be. I'm working on it though.
Yeah. All right. Question 10, and this is the same for every guest. How can my listeners connect with you, get your book, and your film when it drops?
Yeah. So the book is available anywhere books are sold. It's on Amazon. You could order it online from Barnes & Noble. If you want to get it from your local bookstore, if you tell them, they'll be able to order it for you if it's not already there. Or, you know, you can order it to independent bookstore, I think, through goodreads.com. And then you can connect with me. My website is robeschman.com. I'm on Instagram at robeschman. I'm on Twitter at robeschman. And then the film, you know, I'll be posting information about the film on my social media.
Okay.
But right now it's not publicly available. I think we're going to study it first. We're using it in the lab. And then once we're done with the research side of it, then we'll find a way to make it available for everybody.
Okay. I am so looking forward to that. Honestly, I am. Dr. Rob, thank you. Number one, thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for joining me and sharing part of your day with me and my listeners. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. So guys, Dr. Rob Eshman, like freshman, all his contact info, his website, links to the book, and whenever the film is available for public consumption, all of that will be in the show notes in case you didn't write it down, because I know y'all didn't. And please, please don't forget to visit my website at www.thecandidshop.com. That's Candid with a K. Listen to an episode, drop me a review, and share the show with your friends, please, and thank you. And until the next time we meet, I want all of you to keep it safe, keep it healthy, and keep it candid.